We welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hello. What's up, Kimball?
Well, you know, Carrie's dreaming of being in New Orleans. He's got the beads on. He's having a good old time, but no New Orleans feel here in the studio, really.
Are you nervous about how you're going to handle things on your own?
No. It'll like a breath of fresh air getting him out. No, I haven't even thought about it. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Oh, I see. You sound a bit like that aunt who is warned to get ready for the winter and is like, isn't he an ant? No, he's a grasshopper, right?
Yes, that's what he is. That's right, yes.
And he's like, nah, it'll be fine. I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. And then he is he's in trouble, and he's dependent upon charity and mercy for him to get through. So just be careful, man.
That could be what we're doing next fall. I'll be dependent on charity and mercy, so that wouldn't be the first time. Well, we're talking movies, though, here today, and we've got an interesting slate of films to discuss. And let's begin with a movie from 1944, The Suspect, starring Charles Laughton as a bit of a player.
I don't know that he's a bit of a player because he is, he's not that well. I know you're joking, but he's, to people who haven't seen this film, Charles Laughton is not an actual player.
No.
He has a problem. I guess technically he is stepping out on his wife's thumb in an innocent way, but his wife, oh man, she is just, he's described in the summaries of this film as being henpecked. Henpecked usually suggests that you're a weak guy. He's not a weak guy. He's just a guy who can't take it anymore, and I can't blame him.
Oh, no.
His wife is a mega shrew, and he meets this woman who, in actual years, is 20 years his junior, and they hit it off, and the friendship becomes an actual romance that he tries to stop from happening because his wife won't grant him this divorce. And it's a period piece, and in England, and at that time, it was a bear to get a divorce if the other person didn't want to release you from your obligation, as it were. And there are a number of things I really like about this film, but one of them is that Ella Raines, who is the love interest, it's not a kind of illegitimate romance. I like that she loves him. She actually loves him. She's a fine young thing, Kimball. She is an attractive young woman. And Charles Laughton is maybe not the most dapper of players. I mean, he did okay for himself on really both sides of the fence, as it worked out. But I like that she actually loves him. And there is an innocence to their union. And I find that touching, because at first you're wondering, what direction is this film going to go in? Is she just going to reject him, and it's going to be, oh, well, we're friends, and I can't believe you thought we were anything more than that? But he has some extra bits in his life that he needs to get out of the way first.
Yeah, what I like among a number of things is that Laughton does some pretty darn good and often subtle acting, as opposed to quite often when he'd be chewing up the scenery, and it's tempered a bit in this, and I like this Charles Laughton.
He's good, and that's a key component of his character too, is his actual likability. You really like the people in this film, with the exception of the Laughton character's wife. And it's strange to say that you like the Laughton character, because he is he's murdering, and he's trying to get away with it. And that's interesting, too, that notion of that gray area. When we hear about murder in the abstract, we always think it's just a horrible person, and it's someone who's made a horrible decision to do a horrible act. And so there's no getting around it. But when we go into the lives of people in a film or a novel, an extended TV series, the person who does a murder, when we see other aspects of their life, and this is, film is a good example, we don't hate them. We don't really condemn them. So we sort of get pulled into that guilt, that wrongness, as it were, too, because he could get away with this, and he gives himself up because he wants to help someone. Does two murders, actually. He the guy he murders has it coming. But he wants to help out his victim's widow. He doesn't want her to suffer for his crime. And so the detective pursuing the Lawton character is actually banking on his sense of duty and honor and justice to get him caught.
I was reading, too, that to promote the movie, they did a 30-minute radio version. And in the radio broadcast, which I guess mostly aired on New York stations, Orson Welles played the Charles Lawton role.
Oh, you could definitely see Welles in this role, in this film, even. It's not that far off from The Stranger, a couple years after this. So Lawton and Welles were similar actors. They both had the voice going for them. They had, especially as Welles went along, they had the bulk, that physical commanding presence. And that wasn't a bad thing. And if you look at the original one sheet, the movie poster for this film, it's quite insulting to Lawton. It makes of it almost a Beauty and the Beast.
Right,
they
right.
Had this strange kind of love. And you know what? I like people who like someone for what they are. And for instance, I was thinking about Tom Brady today. When Tom Brady is with someone again, he's officially partnered, do you think there's any way that he's not going to pick the absolute hottest woman he can find? That's just kind of how it's going to go, right? Imagine how shocking it would be if you saw Tom Brady with this brilliant woman who was, like, pretty, but someone you could see down at the coffee shop or something, because of how much he was into who she was, and that alone, and that she was attractive was important, too, to him, but you know that he doesn't make choices that way.
Right.
When someone has a lot of money and they're older and someone dies, I guess you could use Robert Kraft for this one, you know they're going to pick, if they can, the most attractive physical person that they can get. And this is actual love in this film. And it's touching. It's a love based on friendship. And that doesn't mean that it's solely platonic. Their friends don't question their relationship. Their friends are probably really happy for them. It's cool. The only problem is there are these people in the Lawton character's orbit that suck.
Yes.
And you know what, Kimball? Sometimes you just have to go for it, I feel like. I wasn't that upset when he takes out his wife. I bet you weren't either. I was like, good, finally. She had it coming.
I was happy to see Cora go. Yes, I have no question about that. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown from The Suspect, the 1944 film. We moved to 1952, and a film called The Wild North. That it's a bit of a Western. It's some interesting casting in it. I think most notably, Sid Charisse, best known as a dancer, partner of Fred Astaire on more than one occasion, as an Indian woman.
He is the female love interest of Stuart Granger's character. Stuart Granger's character is this this bygone era, almost, figure of a renegade of the woods who lives to his own code, and society is becoming more mechanized and modern, and he is still this agrarian, outdoor, rural figure, and he's going down the river with her in their canoe, and he ends up killing this guy that they've taken along for the ride. He didn't really have a choice if they were going to live. This wasn't a good guy. It's safe to kill this guy, but the cops, the police, in the form of Wendell Corey, is going to be coming for him. And so he thinks that he can wait this out, put the romance on hold. He can wait this out in the deep, snowy, treacherous wilderness. And Wendell Corey, the people will know from Holiday Affair, which a few years before with Robert Mitchum and a very young Janet Leigh, and obviously Rear Window from 54. He's Jimmy Stewart's cop buddy. So he's a different cop here. He's a cop who is relentless until he loses his mind, is going to go after Stuart Granger. And what happens is Stuart Granger is having to take in the cop character. It goes the other way around because the cop reaches his breaking point in the woods with a scene that I think has to number, probably it's not a horror film, but scene where they're attacked by these wolves, and the timing of the scene and the pace at which it unfurls, and how the wolves set up their serried ranks and go in these waves of attack. Very believable, very scary. And then, like I said, the Wendell Corey character goes out of his mind after that, and it's up to Stuart Granger to bring him in.
And, boy, it's a beautifully shot, too. I don't know, did they film it in Canada? Do you know?
A lot of it was done on location and at two different stints, because Stuart Granger had some light sort of comedy to make. They shot in the summer, and a lot of the night scenes were shot during the day, day for night shooting. You don't see that very much anymore, but it was tricky to shoot at night back then. But you could shoot during the day, call it night, and then have these processing effects to make it look believable as having happened at night. And so that's a lot of what we get, because there are a lot of night scenes in this film. Another one that's memorable is when these two drifters, but this is a country where almost everyone's a drifter, come into the camp. And did you notice who one of them was? Ray Teal, who was Sheriff Roy Coffey on Bonanza.
Oh, I had not noticed it, but now that you mention it, yeah.
He would be in these films like for a minute or two. And I remember in high school, we were watching a film. And so I'm like 16, 17 years old. And I said to the teacher afterwards something about Ray Teal. Well, he just could not understand how I was picking out these random actors. He was this older gentleman in these films. He's Ray Teal. He's from Bonanza. He's Roy Coffey. Before that, like, no, I know. I just didn't expect you to know. So that's a great scene where there's this battle, and it's an effective device to have two people who are on ostensibly oppositional sides pair up with each other. I think that's something that we can't resist, and it's the natural environment that makes these two guys become allies, but they don't have to become allies. Stuart Granger could leave this guy there. His character could leave him behind, and you couldn't really fault him because he is innocent of this murder. And he's also the person who's going to save the Wendell Corey character in the end and bring him back into the real world and snap him out of his snow fog that he's suffering from.
And Stuart Granger's an interesting guy. He had a long career, did a lot of films, did a lot of television shows. Apparently, according to a lot of reports, not the nicest guy in the world to work with, and sometimes mailed in some performances. But this was a pretty good role for him, I thought.
It suited for him. He said something to the effect that he wasn't much of an actor, but he was like pretty good at playing Stuart Granger. he's kind of Stuart Granger in this. He's that strapping, barrel-chested, free-spirited outdoorsman. I'm not saying that he was someone who could survive out in the snows and all of that, but it's closer, I think, to who he was. So it's a film where you could really, he gives the best performance in the film by far. His is the most riveting character. I feel like if you stepped away from this film and thought, that is going to be my guy for the next couple weeks of movies I'm watching, what else does he have? I think you would be let down, because you're not going to get the same thing here. And by the way, every time that the Andy Griffith Show comes on now and I see Aunt B, I think about you telling me that she was this harridan. And I looked into the matter because it bothers me. Every time she's sweet with Opie, and it bothers me now. She repented at the end of her life and sent Andy Griffith like a note apologizing saying, I'm sorry that I got too big for my britches. Because she was upset that she was thought of as just Aunt B. Well, who do you want to be, Lady Macbeth? I mean, who do you think you are?
Right.
So she had this end of her life sort of atonement, and it makes me feel a little bit better when I watch the Andy Griffith Show now.
Oh, good. I'm glad she did that. From the Wild North to a wonderful short from 1933, Laurel and Hardy. And busybodies, and man, and a great advance in automobile technology with the car radio that they devised.
The boys are going to work, and they have the white gloves on. Always reminds me. You didn't see his hands, but I always feel like Papagino would have. You remember that guy, Papagino?
Yes.
The pizza dude?
Yeah.
I feel like he would have white gloves on. And they're white gloves. They're not even, they're kind of scuzzed up. They're not even clean. So I don't know why they're formal gloves almost, but they're wearing them all the time. They're going past these palm trees, and they're driving to work, and they're giving thanks for the day. It's such a great day. And they talk about having a radio, which you could have in your car at the time, but not in a junker like this. And so we see this opening gag of that they have a record player stuffed under the hood of the car, and Stan gets out and changes it. And they're working in the lumber industry. So there are going to be a lot of saws in this film. And Buster Keaton is the best of the single silent clowns. The duo analog for Keaton is Laurel and Hardy. They have the films that have aged the best on that partner side of it. I think really of any group. Count the Marx Brothers in there, obviously more than a duo. But there is something elegiac about Laurel and Hardy. And the rhythm of this film, it builds in its pacing and its cadences, where we're seeing almost Three Stooges type of slapstick and hitting about the head as it begins. But it really develops this symphonic kind of rhythm to it in the pacing of the gags, the percussiveness of the acting performances, the hands-on somatic quality of it, the beats when Hardy gives a look to the camera. And there are these surreal aspects, too, that become wilder and wilder as we go along, because it's the surreal rooted in a kind of sense. So when Hardy ends up in this tube inside of this lumber yard, if you notice, there's a beat where even though he's underground, he's going through whatever. Of course, you would die from this. You wouldn't even fit, that kind of thing. He still shoots you the look. He gives you, like, what a fine mess I'm in. And it's funny because if you saw any part of this film, really, as a clip, a kind of basketball highlight, it wouldn't really mean anything to you. But if you sit there and you watch the 18 minutes, it really wins you over, convinces you in its rhythms of something really comedically profound, even.
And they're so good, too, that the dialogue, what little there is almost unnecessary.
In this film, right, you have, how many words do you even get from Laurel? It's probably less than 25.
Mm.
And Hardy was going to be the one who was the MC for the duo, I guess you could say. And he gets pretty voluble in other films. He doesn't have much to say in this. You could cut a silent version of this film, and it wouldn't be completely the same, because there are a lot of sound effects. The dialogue is really from this lumberyard. It's from the saws and everything. And I'm scared of sharp things. And so the pacing of it is perfect when they are fleeing from their boss, because they're getting fired anyway, probably because of everything, the hell, the chaos that they've let loose. They're driving away again in the car. They get the car sliced in two. It's like a Gordon Matta Clark type of architectural expression by this bandsaw. As they're going past the bandsaw of death, do you notice how, like, they each give it this slow, kind of fascinated look with their heads following it as they pass?
Oh, yes, and I'm yelling, get away from that saw, boys.
They're admiring it the way you would water falling over a cliff, but a delicate sort of beam of water, not the full-on waterfall. And then, because there's a closure to their film, there's a natural arc, Laurel thinks that he can improve, put a positive spin on things with music, which they both enjoy. So he starts, he returns to the stereo system, the car, goes to play a record. And Hardy's going to be into it for a second. Then he catches himself and thinks, oh, you suck, man. And Laurel catches on to the idea the exact same second. Off Laurel flees with Hardy chasing him another day out for the boys.
That's a wonderful movie. Another fascinating film. It's, I think, one that was the template for a lot of experimental film in future years. 1943's, is it Maya Deren? Is that how she says her name? Her terrific film, Meshes of the Afternoon.
Made with her husband. And it's a lot like the Laurel and Hardy film, I would say, in that you have that notion of surreality that makes sense. We've talked about in the past how weird is good when weird works. Surreal is effective when it makes sense. And this is a film that reminds me, it's only 14 minutes long. It reminds me of the cinematic version of something like the Beatles' A Day in the Life, because nothing in this film is really literal, and it's structured like a song. It has these verses and verses, chorus that repeats. The film resets at several points with this driveway sequence. When we go back to the driveway, and on the driveway is going to be the female protagonist of the picture, who is Maya Deren herself. It's going to be this grim reaper type of female figure. There's going to be a flower and everything. But it could be as simple and as complex as an idea, as a rumination on a day in the life of a marriage, that there are high points and low points within every day. And every day is a sort of mini murder. It's a day that's come off the duration of your life. Another day has been killed. We've seen that expression before. We talk about killing time. And so the movie can simply be encapsulating what it's like to be in a domestic partnership. You have moments where somebody irks you, perhaps, with something they've said. You have moments of tranquility. You have moments of boredom. But there's nothing actually boring in this film. And you have also a murder mystery without a murder, which sounds strange because we do have the image of a dead body at the end, but it's not a literal body. It's a cloaking of seaweed and everything, and seaweed could have gone into this place. It's just what you think in your head. It's what you think when you dream. It's what you think in that moment before you begin to fall asleep. It's just the life blown up at that kind of id cortex center of who we are.
Yeah, and I think dream is such an important word. It's a very much a dreamlike film. The scenes, and I think it happens two or three times, of her taking the key out of her mouth. It's just, wow, it's incredibly powerful. And I went back and watched it a second time to see if I'd missed anything, but it was brilliantly shot.
I think we have to be careful with that idea of dream, because dream is often a cop-out. And this is too sophisticated to be a cop-out. There is a rigorous realism in this picture. We think about our keys. Our keys are so central to who we are. They let us into our home, our safe space, our inner world, our in the physical sense. And so I have these kind of panic moments of thinking about forgetting keys and saying to myself, okay, next time you're at the 7-Eleven, why don't you make a set and stash it somewhere? And we have, again, these simple images of the domestic scene, the bread, the knife that keeps showing up, sometimes replaced by the key or turns into the key. It can be a marriage where the love is gone. It can be a marriage of comfort. It can be a marriage that works where the love is present. We have all of these extremes that go through our head throughout the day. We don't think in the middle of the road, if you will, in our head when we're progressing through our feelings. We sort of have these initial feelings that often are not. I saw the same guy today, and he was, at first I thought he wasn't a guy, and then I looked up, and he was a little hipster with a little beard, and he was walking his dogs, and he had this smirk on his face, it seemed. And then when I was coming back from the cafe just now to take your call, I saw him again, minus the dogs, and again I thought it was like a woman, and I looked up, and it was, you were smirking. I don't like this guy. And I'm realizing that that's an extreme reaction. That's not rational. It's not how I really would feel about this person. But we have 1,000 of those every day. And this is just the cinematic, I think, representation of that.
Finally, a really outstanding animated version of a Sherlock Holmes, A Study in Scarlet. And I never would have thought of this casting, but boy, it works so well with Peter O'Toole as Holmes.
Yeah, I wonder why I agreed to that. I wonder how, like, life in his career came to being in this animated Australian Sherlock Holmes adaptation. And it sounds, another Sherlock Holmes. But there aren't a ton of animated Sherlock Holmes adaptations that are played straight, where they're giving you, here's the story. There's the one where Sherlock Holmes is in the future and he's a robot or something. They're all of those. But it almost begs the question, why? Why are we doing this? Is it to get kids into Sherlock Holmes? I guess it could have been that. It's fairly stiff in its presentation, in its actual animation, in its acting. I'd say, I think it was probably a paycheck for Peter O'Toole. He doesn't endow the character with any peculiarities that you take away and think, oh yeah, he had a way of saying that word or something. But it's highly watchable, and if you were a kid, I could see this being a gateway for you into these stories, because there really isn't anything else that does it. Like, you wouldn't, even the Rathbone and Bruce pictures, which you could see as a kid, and they were always airing as a matinee, I don't think they would have gripped you that much. They were still played for adults.
Yeah, it's very well done. And again, I don't know what brought them all together and if it was just a payday, but I was thinking of the timing. It was, I think, 83 or 84. So that would have been, I believe, after the success that O'Toole had making My Favorite Year, which was a bit of a bounce back for him.
It's the novel where they meet, where Holmes and Watson meet, A Study in Scarlet. And for whatever reason, they leave that out. That's really one of the best parts, I think. You know how, like, if you're watching Return of the Jedi and they're going off to Endor, and the gang is back together again, and they talk about, like, in the good old days, right? And you think, if you've seen that movie enough, maybe you stop and think, how many times did they all that we know of really fly off together and do stuff? It really was like once or twice. It wasn't that common. But A Study in Scarlet is the good old days moment for people who are into Holmes and Watson, because we get the origin story of how these guys met, that they couldn't afford the rent, and Watson is really in a bad way. He's depressed, and he's not able to afford his hotel room, and he just runs into this third party, and he snaps at him. He's really brutish. He apologizes. Holmes is doing okay, but he can't afford a place to live on his own, and they left that out entirely. I think that's something that you want to have. And that was strange to me that wasn't included, because that kind of makes the novels aren't as good as the short stories. So there are 4 novels. There are 56 short stories. And when you think about the Sherlock Holmes that you remember, that you most want to see, excepting Hound of the Baskervilles, everything else is a short story. The other three novels, of which this is one, they're too reliant on using stuff from America to sort of fill up the plot. And that really wasn't Conan Doyle's deal. And so there's some of that. But in here, you probably notice it's gappy. It just jumps. We're in America. We're in the West. We're not really given an explanation for it. And I think if I was a kid watching it, that really would have baffled me if I didn't know the source material.
Colin Fleming every Tuesday here on Downtown. Next week, we'll talk more films, including The Republic serial from 1941, The Adventures of Captain Marvel, the 1993 film Stellar, an adaptation of Poe's Fall of the House of Usher, and the underappreciated Killdozer, which I remember watching in high school many, many years ago. I cannot wait to revisit that one.
It's not like we were talking about. The Killdozer is made for TV movie. It's not as dumb. The way I'd say it to people is that it kind of has the thing. It has a vibe of the thing from another world to it. It just happens to involve bulldozers. Even the title, like, can you imagine, like, you're at the meeting for that and you're pitching ideas? Because Killdozer isn't even really a faithful kind of pun. It's like wrong. And someone finally says, Killdozer. And then someone else says, got it.
Right. That's gold, baby. That's gold.
Yeah, we're done here. Let's lunch. Yeah.
That's coming up next week. You won't want to miss it. Colin, we'll talk with you then.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.